In your book, you had a line that says, handle pain with respect. What did you mean by that?
If we acknowledge it and we give it the respect that it deserves, because pain is an indicator that something happened that is not supposed to happen.
How do we get to know that this is my true self and it's not a reflection of who I think I should be or what I want to be or what I see on social media?
You need to really define the why. If it is to please somebody else, it's not going to be long term. If the desire is to discover the gold within you that God created, that would be the right why.
Why is change so hard?
It's mostly avoidance-driven choices that we make. So we have two kind of main motivators in life. The one is love and the one is fear. If your baseline emotional state is one of irritation, anger, frustration, those are the exclamation marks. Let's say change is needed.
Wow. I'm literally speechless. Dr. Gary, you are a cognitive behavioral therapist, an author, wife, mother, and a woman who conducts her life and work in such a way that brings honor to God. I like to start these conversations by asking, what is the earliest context that we need to understand about you that made you the woman that you are today?
Hi, Marco. I'm also a grandmom.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, which is a,
let's add that to the title.
A wonderful experience. I grew up in a very stable Afrikaans Christian home. And I think the stability that was provided there was really good and healthy, and just a love and a passion to be available for God, to be in His working in His kingdom. I think that was, I always wanted to be a dominie, and then it was just whether a woman can or not, whatever, and eventually decided to do a BSc with biochemistry and botany, and then only years after that I started with the psychology. So, but during that time of studying BSc, I was always, even through, you know, through high school, people would come and just pour their hearts out. And I think that default kind of way of seeing how things just turn out and flow out, I think that was where I realized, but I actually love talking to people. I love listening to them. I love to see, even while they are talking, how I can encourage them or support them or whatever. And I think the combination of that, as well as my real desire to be working in the kingdom, that kind of joined together.
Did you always have the passion? I'm trying to understand in terms of thinking of becoming a pastor and then transitioning into psychology. Is it the fact that you wanted to help people and bring them either closer to God or closer to themselves that brought you interest into that field?
Yes, yes. What actually happened is, I did a lot of different kinds of jobs, even taught science at a high school for a while, tried to sell homes, being a medical rep. So it was various, working in a microbiology lab, etc., etc. And then when we moved to Cape Town, which was about 28 years ago, I started to work with Lifeline. And through that, my path crossed with somebody who was in a ministry, and she said, why don't you come and join me for my ministry, or with my ministry? And that was actually where it all started, because that just opened up doors to counseling courses, et cetera, and starting to counsel in a group with friends. And then I decided, why don't I go back onto the academic kind of road? And there I started to study psychology through UNISA and eventually Stellenbosch, and the psychology was, it was an outflow of the passion to work with people.
You wrote a book called A Change of Heart. What inspired you to explore the theme of change?
It's just the possibility and the availability and the need to grow. And to grow, you know, movement is something that can either take you forward or backward. But growth is always movement in the forward direction. And the aim, the why behind change, you need to really define the why. If it is to please somebody else, or because there's pressure to change for someone else to be more acceptable, it's not going to be long-term change at all. If the desire is to discover the gold within you that God created in you, to align with His truth about who you are, then that would be the right motivation. That would be the right why. And that would really energize you to get onto that path to identify and be willing to identify the stuff that is not in line with His truth, things that are really limiting you, that's harmful to you and to others. And then also to say, okay, right, let me do whatever I need to do. And sometimes that would include moving through pain and through becoming aware of stuff that's in you that's really not nice to know about. Things that we have suppressed, maybe childhood stuff that you suppressed, that you dissociated from because it was so intense and so painful. And change will always require that kind of confrontation. But the outflow and the fruit from pushing through will always be beautiful.
We had a discussion before the podcast, the team and I, and we wondered, how do you know when you should change? Like, when is it like something that you can say, this is literally who I am? It's part of my DNA and this is just me. Is that even a right statement to make? And also, like, what are the clear indications in your life that change is needed? Is it when you hurt people? Is it when you hurt yourself? Or what are those signs that kind of is going to lead you to a point of discovery and emotional intelligence in terms of, I need to go on this journey to change?
Always, how do you behave? Your behavior. How do you cope with relationships? What is the fruit that is visible and measurable in relationships, and as well as in how you handle life, the challenges of life? If your baseline emotional state is one of irritation, anger, frustration, impatience, bitterness, hatred, those kind of fruit, those are the exclamation marks, the red dots that say change is needed. And the always again the desire to be aligned with who God you truly made you to be. You know, if you're out of line there, the order, the harmony is not in here, the peace is not here. So when you don't have that kind of peace and harmony inside, that inner peace, that would also be I think an alarm that should motivate you to say change is needed. But it's mostly the measurable outflow, the fruit of relationships and just general, how do you cope with life, how do you function. And then what is incredible is, you know, that old saying of, in Afrikaans you say, so gemaak en so laat staan. So often people will use that to justify the almost unwillingness to go there, in the there that's needed to activate the change. But change is what is so fascinating in the physical sense. There's a study field called epigenetics. Epi is for additional, and genetics is the genetic, your whole genome, your inherited data that you have. So epigenetics is the study field where you see how experiences, life experiences, what you are exposed to can actually activate or deactivate different coding in your DNA, in your genetic codes. So it doesn't change the sequence of your DNA, it changes the expression. like you have a different kind of active and inactive, like a binary code in your, let's say, your eye, than you would have in your leg or in your muscle, because you need different kind of cells to be activated and processes to be activated. But the same goes with thinking and how you process things and how you interpret things and how you choose to behave, what becomes your default behavioral choice. And that is the field of epigenetics, is just to say that there is an absolute proof that change is measurable in behavior. And it's not correct to say that you are not able to change. There's a core personality that will not change, but how you allow and give permission to others' behaviors or usual triggers to impact your choice of behavior, your decision making, your priorities, that is what is part of change, and that is what where change needs to take place.
It makes me think of this idea that I've been thinking about and exploring, that we were almost made perfect in God's image, and as we grew up and as we got exposed to the world and all the pain and all the things that surround sin and all of those things kind of takes away and shapes and molds us in a different way, in a different direction.
Mm.
And that makes us less of the man, less of the woman that we should be. Is that an accurate way of thinking about how we go from birth to where we are in our 20s and 30s and then discovering that what went wrong in those earlier years, that we should then actively start working on the change and healing?
Mm. Yeah, it's a loaded question. So I think to answer that question, I believe we have a perfect creator who really is so invested in our lives, and he has equipped us with everything that we require to be in harmony with him and to have safe and godly attachments with him. That scripture that says there's highways between our heart and his heart. Those are the highways that I think that should be our default connection points and attachments. And so, yes, I think the coherence and the harmony should have been there from right at the start. But unfortunately, I think even a baby during birth, during womb time, actually, even from conception, there's already inherited data that depicts certain tendencies, certain way of dealing with life, certain maybe even trauma can be inherited. So there might be a little bit of a battle to work through those things. But I honestly believe, even with a field of epigenetics in mind, is that when a baby are really cared for, when they feel safe and loved and welcome, those three things, and their basic needs are met, it's really necessary, you know, it's a requirement for them to actually grow and develop in a healthy adult, a mature person who can bless and impact the community. So I think even in your brokenness you are born, if you have that kind of correct and loving environment and safe environment, I really think the chances are good that you will grow. But I've seen so many different people who've really had a very difficult and challenging childhood, but through choices and really digging into the Word of God and connecting with Him and restoring that attachment, that the inner harmony gets restored.
What type of advice would you give, since we're such an emotionally aware culture, and with young adults really being more in tune with their feelings, intentional with the way they act, what advice would you give young parents today in terms of creating an environment? You mentioned those three characters now. How does that practically look in terms of how you should conduct yourselves when you're pregnant or around a newborn, to kind of instill the best possible case scenario for a healthy upbringing and childhood?
Also a loaded question. There's so many pointers that one can share with a parent, with a new parent, but to be proactive, to really prepare yourself, if possible, so that you have that inner harmony, you are connected with the one who is creating the one within you, and then to form a foundation intentionally of unconditional acceptance and love. There's some real basic needs, like little cups that needs to be filled, even from conception onwards. And you need to understand what those basic needs are and how you can actually minister to that young one, because he or she is completely dependent, 100% dependent on the caretaker, on the parent, for that, at least for the first 6 years or whatever. So it's really important that you understand what does unconditional love look like. And if that foundation is poured and it's safe and it's secure and it's there and you communicate it verbally and non-verbally in various ways, then I think when the discipline eventually comes, it's on a safe ground and it's encouraging. It's not. It will not bear fruit of rebellion and pushing away the parent. But I think one thing, a parent, I think the generational time that we are, season that we are in for our teens, our young adults, is the desperation to have a safe and secure home and to have really very safe friendships and attachments with their parents. For the parents to know, even though they are not always nice people, these teens of theirs, they are hungry to still have a relationship with the father and the mother and have them invested in their lives.
Mm. Sure. If we return to the subject of change, why is change so hard? Why, even though we know the things that we have identified in our own lives that needs change, or like you said, in the relationships that we have, we can see that there's toxicity or something that comes out that is not the way that it should be, that is not from God, that is not truth. Like, why is it so hard, even knowing that, to actually translate that into practical and active change?
I think there's a few reasons. It's avoidance, you know, it's mostly avoidance driven choices that we make. So we have two kind of main motivators in life. The one is love and the one is fear. And when we have formed either one or the other one, even in the womb, even prior to birth, that would be our default way of attaching to people and building relationships and even with ourselves. And if it was a fear bond, let me first say love bonds is based on that unconditional acceptance and love. There's, if you have a love bond with somebody, transparency is one of the key elements of that relationship, honesty, closeness. You don't mind being in that person's presence. You don't walk on eggshells around that person. You don't think too much before you open your mouth and share your thoughts. But fear bonds are always avoidance driven. You try and avoid in that relationship rejection, humiliation, punishment, failure, disappointment, all those kind of negative outflows. You try and avoid, so that's why you choose this reaction or that reaction, or I'm not going to say this, I'm not going to do this. Now, the ratio, it's impossible to live only on love bonds, so the ratio should be 5 times love versus the 1 fear in any kind of relationship. But if the base is fear, that would be the default kind of relationship you have with yourself as well, and often also with God. So you're trying to avoid pain and the humiliation that maybe goes with that, the shame that goes with that. Oftentimes it's acknowledging that my mom wasn't the person that she should have been. And to go there it's difficult because we have this inner conflict. We have to have a safe and nurturing mom. We have to have a safe and caring and a father that protects. But what if he's the one that's the abuser? And then you automatically go to the default thinking of maybe I need to change. Maybe I must. But it's all fear driven. If I can avoid that outburst again, I can do that if I don't talk back, or if I kind of just disappear in the background in his life or in his world. So as long as there's fear as motivator in your choices, I think the avoidance will be there to work against change. It's the what if, you know, and I think that's the main thing. We don't feel safe enough to move and confront through the pain.
And how would one start a journey of change then? If we so, let's say we are reluctant and we are drawing away from that, but there is a bit of us that is willing enough to say that I'm at a place in my life where the damage is getting so severe in the relationships in myself that I'm ready for change. How do you start that process? Do you need to go see somebody? Do you start with inner work? How does that process get off the ground?
That would be a beautiful place to be. If you are desperate for change, you can be motivated also to go from where I am now to where I want to be. And I always say the best motivation is to move towards something that you really want and desire instead of moving away from something that you don't want anymore. So you need to have both those angles ready, but the main one should be moving forward to get to there. Again, the why is necessary to analyze, but I think that place of desperation is good. And that's why behavior and relationships are the ones who kind of nudge us to say, this change is really necessary. And often it takes our partners, our friends that would be brutally honest to us and say, how you handled that is really, really bad. You really need to take some responsibility for that and get help or do whatever you need to do to change. So if the desire is there, there are ample avenues. I mean, nowadays you can go on any kind of YouTube teaching or grab a book or whatever. There's so many material available. If you battle, it's always healthy to go and see someone that you can journey with. Yeah.
There's two factors there that I want to chat about. The one being, obviously, if there's trauma from the childhood, there's some healing necessary before you can actually just go to the picture that you want to have, right? So so the question one, part A, is how do you deal with, first of all, how do you acknowledge that your father did or your mother did or this situation or this abuse or whatever, how do you get to that, or to the journey of actually healing that, and how do you do that part? And then the part two question is, how do we truly know ourselves that well within the eyes of God to know what the picture should look like as to where we need to be as a man and as a woman?
Yeah. So I think when you realize there was suppressed trauma, or you become aware of the impact of the childhood trauma, the key thing is not to stick to that incident or that season in your life to get stuck there, but to unpack it, to acknowledge it, to unpack it on the table, and to look at how did this influence me. It influences you in the way you look at life. It may influence you the way that you look at God, as well as how you look at yourself and life in general, others. And those are the aspects that you need to analyze and say, but maybe trauma is like a wound in the spirit, and wounds attract flies. The flies, you can almost see as symbolism of lies. And lies would be if a parent hurt you, abused you in any way, even neglect is viewed as a form of abuse. a very serious form of abuse. Then you have to say, okay, but how did that impact me? I felt not worthy to be, I'm not attention worthy or love worthy. Okay, but that's a lie. I am. It wasn't their choice for me to be born. It was God's choice for me to be born. And to analyze that scenario, to say, okay, what lies and what misconceptions came through that, and what do I need to do with that? And the whole process of change is actually to look at what you believe, your heart's convictions, what your truth is, and how it compares with God's truth. And the heart's question is actually, who am I? So the whole process of change is to get the who am I, the self-definition, aligned with who God says you are. And so you remember and recall trauma only for the purpose of seeing where the damage of lies came in, what they are, and how can I exchange them to what God says I am.
Wow. Does that mean that the Bible basically paints the picture of who we should be? Or do you think that everybody has its own unique self-truth in terms of who you should be? Like, is there uniqueness in me and uniqueness in you and in everybody that basically depicts that within the truth of God, this is the person who you should be? Or how do you answer that question, that this is the most authentic self and this is who I should aspire to be?
So there's definite unique personalities, and I think that is what is so exciting, is when we are not cookie cutters at all. We are beautifully, uniquely made. And within that, I believe when you discover that, when you discover the gold within your star qualities and your squiggle qualities, you know, and you become unconditionally acceptable towards yourself as well, then you give yourself the liberty, the freedom to actually flourish and blossom and grow and impact your community in the best way possible. It's almost like the uniqueness of our fingerprints, but we've got a heart print, our uniqueness here, that actually says, when I align with my uniqueness here to what who God says I am, I'm valuable, I'm precious, I'm loved unconditionally, I'm acceptable, I'm attention worthy. And it's not the focus on me, me, me. It's the moment you discover that, that you can start to love him with a whole heart. When we are broken, our attention is very much, what about me? This isn't fair. And that taking offense kind of approach to life. But when we become whole, we can start to ooze out the love and the truth of who he says we are.
If I hear the word conditional quite prevalent in the dialogue. If we struggle with unconditional love, let's say the past traumas, maybe you're struggling to forgive the parent or to find the balance between, I still love you, but because you hurt me in such a way, this is how I'm going to protect with boundaries or whatever the case might be. But if unconditional love, because I think we live in a culture where unconditional love is not something that comes naturally. Mm. It's all about us. Now, I need to protect me and self-love and self-care and self-everything. But that does not open up the gates to unconditional love. It actually closes them a little bit more in terms of, it's more like you said, it's about me and I need to protect myself and therefore I'm going to cut the tie, I'm going to do this, I'm going to do that. Instead of forgiving, loving from a place of wholeness. So how do we find the balance between protecting ourselves, living unconditionally, and having those healthy boundaries to still protect ourselves in such a way, but not to be self-centered?
So if you compare yourself to a pillar and you are standing, that pillar is standing on a foundation, your foundation there would be birthright. And in the book, I think it's part two, I start with, what are your rights? And one of the basic ones is your birthright. With that comes a few others as well. for instance, the power to choose, the right to choose, the right to know the truth, the right to be here and to be alive. So that's the foundation. Now your pillar is built on that. Your pillar consists of your self-definition. And the more you know who you are, again, the squiggles and the star qualities, the more secure that pillar would be and the finer the pores on the outside would be, the more selective you would be regarding others' behavior, what behavior actually penetrates right through and impact your self-definition and what just bounces off. And that's where the boundaries come in, because you are more selective. And if you apply boundaries fear-driven, it's damaging. It is so damaging. And I see that boundaries have become a buzzword. And it is applied in fear, and then the anger comes. Fear and anger, if you see anger, you know that person is afraid of something. They always join together, because anger is an effort to protect. And it's a godly emotion. It's good, it's healthy, it's needed. But it's not always, if it's not managed, it's damaging. But it's an indicator of the presence of fear. And then you have to look at, what am I afraid of? And if your boundaries are communicated out of fear, it's going to damage relationships, which had the potential to be beautiful relationships. So it has to be love-driven, and that's where the wisdom needs to come in.
If we are on a journey to truly become our best selves, what are some practical tips that one can follow to kind of build that picture? Let's say I want to become the best Marco I can be. What steps should I follow in terms of identifying the things that I should change, and also the things that I should perhaps build on? Because obviously this, we talk about the things that need healing and changing, that might be bad, but obviously the good qualities you want to amplify in terms of what is really working for you. But how do we honestly, with all those outside efforts like social media and TV and Netflix and everything media that goes on around us, how do we get to know that this is my true self and it's not a reflection of who I think I should be or what I want to be or what I see on social media? Because especially with the driven of fear and like I have to be that or I need to chase these goals, I often think that we operate from a place where we broadcast more than we actually live from within. And from a place of godly truth that lives within us. So if we want the best way to be the best version of ourselves, but to do it in such a way that it's not based on what we see from the outside, how do you get to that deepest root of yourself?
So the question would be, why do you want to be the best version of the Marco? Of Marco?
I think for me, it would be so I can be the best vessel for God in terms of the way that I reflect his character, one, and two, that the time that I have on earth can create the most impact. If I had to bring it down to two, it would be that.
Those
I want
basic
to
ones,
expose
yeah.
his character for how amazing he is and let that character show within me, and then whatever I do, make sure it has impact.
And with that, I'm not going to ask you again, but the on that beautiful answer, you can again ask yourself, why? Why do I want to make an impact? And why do I want to reflect his glory? And that why can also reveal whether your relationship with God is, do you feel conditionally accepted and loved by him, or don't you? And is the relationship with him love-driven or fear-driven? And that's really important, because if we are settled and secure in his absolute deep, pure, safe love for us, and we feel so completely safe with him and his investment in our lives, then we will be willing to open up and invite his light in. and not feel threatened by that light that exposes and reveals, and so, because there's no shame involved in that. There's just encouragement. So the why is really important, to get to the bottom of the motivation behind it, the energy behind it, and then to actually say, but I actually just want to, we are born to bring him glory and to have a relationship with him. So whatever hinders the quality of relationship with him, that's what I want to get rid of. That's it. Whether it makes a huge impact, measurable and visible and acknowledged, doesn't really matter, because it's all about him. It's not about the impact or others primarily. The outflow will always be there, but primary, it's not the main reason. Does that make
sense? Yeah, it does. Okay. It does. It made me think quite deep about my own reflections. In your book, you had a line that says, "Handle pain with respect." What did you mean by that?
If we try to avoid pain, and pain that goes with maybe past experiences or present experiences, then we will not confront that aspect, and we will constantly try and suppress it. If we acknowledge it and we give it the respect that it deserves, because pain is an indicator that something happened that is not supposed to happen and that is potentially harmful. And if we acknowledge it and we deal with it in a respectful way, we will actually turn towards it, invite God's Spirit to be part of this and unpack and actually spend time to analyze, where's the damage in what I've just experienced? Did it penetrate right through that pillar of identity and impact and brought confusion and disharmony regarding who I am in him? Did it impact my view of him, of life, of others? How did this experience impact me? And that's actually where the beauty and the gold comes from painful experiences.
It makes me think, like your title, A Change of Heart, and I almost want to ask the question, how do we get to a point where we live from the heart? Like this, once again, a two-part question. Is it able, are we able to reach a state of full harmony within ourselves? Is it humanly possible that we can get so rid of the damage and the pain and the healing and be so securely focused in the truth of God that we almost experience a full sense of harmony? And the whole treatment of heart within the title, and you mentioned the heart-centered model, does that mean that harmony sense lives within your heart and less in your brain, in terms of making all these decisions that I should be doing that, I shouldn't do this, I need to heal from that, I need to make that decision, but rather from a deep connectedness and a contentness in heart? Or what is the kind of play there between heart and change?
So my whole philosophy is that if change does not take place at heart level, and I'll explain what I mean with that just now, then it might not be long term. So, and I've dealt with people right through the 25 years plus that we only focus on the spiritual stuff, or we only focus on the emotional stuff, and then a year later or 6 months later they back to square one, they battle. So the whole philosophy was born out of that somewhere. Where does change take place that will bring a long-term impact, that we don't walk in circles and become discouraged? So the philosophy is that the heart is like, if you compare yourself, man, with a company, then the heart would be the CEO, the director of the company. And if you picture that whole director's table with a meeting, with a decision-making meeting, which you know very well. Then you've got your CEO and you've got your other directors sitting around the table. And those would be the body and the spirit and the will and the emotions and the thoughts, etc., etc. But we as humans, we also along the way have additional directors that we have invited in and appointed. Those would be fear or religion or anger or bitterness or hatred or whatever. Those would also, and they will have full permission to participate in the decision-making process. And sometimes we will have religion and fear sitting right opposite one another. They will work together. They will communicate when there's decision-making because it's a fear-driven way of serving God. A relationship is a heart-connecting way of serving God. But the decision-making process will be finalized. Aislani Homer. He's the final decision, should be the heart saying, and the heart's decision is always based on my truth. And my truth, which isn't always aligned with God's truth, so I call it truth, but it's actually my convictions, how I view life and myself, etc. That would be the final say, even if your spirit would say, but the word says this and this, your heart would say, but I've tried that, doesn't work, this and this and this happened after I did that. And it's also based on your inherited data. So you have to take that into consideration. And the whole process of how you get the new truths that is aligned with God's truth, what's the process to get those truths written on your heart's tablets? And the fascinating part is that when I first wrote 5 years ago the Afrikaans book, and when I did my PhD also on wholeness and the term of holistic, the whole thing of the heart, the whole place and position of the heart in the process of change was really something that I marveled at and that was broken open for me. And after I wrote the Afrikaans Jy Kan Verander and started to work with this, there's so much new research done on the physical heart. So there's a field of study called neurocardiology, and it's cardiologists, it's neuropsychologists and et cetera, et cetera, a whole team. So they formed neurocardiology, and they are studying the heart, the physical heart, and the impact that the physical heart has on the brain. So the heart sends, it communicates with the brain far more than the other way around. You have afferent messages, which is to the brain, efferent messages to the heart. And the heart also has a qualified brain in its own with about 40,000 neurons. And it produces two kind of hormones. One is oxytocin, which is our social hormone. We bond with that. We read facial expressions with that. We build empathy with that. I can go on, but I've tried to put as much as possible in there just to confirm that the physical heart actually so much portrays the role of the spiritual heart. And the other fascinating aspect is that the heart of all the organs actually emanates the highest form of a magnetic electromagnetic field. So we have an electromagnetic field around us, but the heart's magnetic field alone is about 100 times stronger than the brain's, and it reaches about 0.914 meters, so almost a meter in parameter around us. And it influences the environment. We create atmosphere by what's going on in our hearts. Isn't that fascinating? That is just, and that's why we say we're on the same wavelength, or I pick up your vibe. And it's just words that we've been using for years and years and years, and we didn't realize that there's really some significance in that. And then further on, it's measurable with EEGs and ECGs to measure the communication between two humans, or a human within a group, or a human with an animal like his favorite pet, like a dog, the impact. So if you have, they measure the heart rate variation. So you can measure emotional states within the electromagnetic field. You pick up irritation, frustration, hatred. All those things you pick up, you also pick up gratitude, love, peace. And these are people that are not, it's not a faith-based study field. It's scientific study field. And so they are globally trying to motivate people to become more gratitude aware. And but it's all Philippians 4 verse 8. It's think upon everything that is peaceful and pure and lovable and honorable. And if we have that mindset, there's an inner harmony that impacts us. It builds our immune system. It helps us to focus. But it also influences the community and the atmosphere.
Wow. I'm literally speechless.
It's very exciting.
It's insane to think that level of capacity lives within us. And it just makes me think how much more work we should do to protect our hearts, like the Bible says, but to protect our hearts in such a way that when everything flows from that space, that it's a healthy, flourishing, beautiful environment.
Exactly.
Because it actually has a much bigger effect than just the words that we say. There's physical energy that is going out there that basically depicts that this is me, this is who I am, this is my characteristics. Even when we don't open our mouths or do anything physically, it's literally just oozing out of us.
The presence, yes.
Wow,
yes.
That's very special and very unique. And I know the whole book captures this, but if you have to, as we land the plane, if you have to quickly mention the four steps of change, how would you summarize that journey in terms of taking from a place of identifying or pre-identifying to identifying healing? How would you briefly summarize those four steps of change?
So the four steps is based on Moses' prayer, actually, in Exodus 33 verse 13, where he says, God, I want to know you. And that knowing, the word is yada, and it has to do with I want my whole being want to be synchronized with you and your mindset and your will. I want you to be happy with me, and that there's harmony between you and me. And that knowing, the four steps, if you break that open, is to perceive, to recognize, to understand, and to turn. And change has to do with knowing. So you have to first recognize what is going on in my heart that is not in harmony and coherent with the truth. But in order to get there, one has to perceive, and I've built into the book also the ability of the heart to look with your heart and to listen with your heart. And God says it in his word so clearly, time and again. He says, for those who have ears, let them hear, and eyes, let them see. And there's a difference between your physical eyes and ears, although we also filter through those sensory data. But with your heart needs to want to turn towards with an attitude of desiring the truth. And when you have that realigned position, your eyes and your ears are open to receive, even if it confronts and contradicts what your heart's convictions are at that stage. And then that's the perceiving part. And then you start to recognize, ha, there's a truth that I have not entertained and taken as my own truth. And it's not yet my conviction. I need to get that that change process going. And then the understand is actually allowing the settling in. And that's where it's so beautiful. There's a term in psychology called reconsolidation. And consolidation is the forming of long-term memories. Reconsolidation is the same memory, but a fresh new interpretation of what happened. And that's actually, it's also measurable. That's actually when change takes place. You can't change the history and what happened in the past, but you can change the impact and the interpretation of what happened there. And that is actually what takes place with the understanding. I make this new reality my own. And then the turning is where you have to put your words into action, and it actually becomes visible in your behavior. So your body is actually the outflow, and it displays the change that has taken place at heart level. If we say we are one thing but we behave in a different manner, the whole process has not taken place, and it still needs to go and flow through right to heart level, so that it can flow from the heart again outward into how you behave, how you act, and how you build relationships.
How would you, having said everything that we said within this conversation, how would you define a state of wholeness and harmony? And like, what is the ultimate condition in a sentence that you want to experience in life?
It's important to say that we're on a life journey of pursuing that, and pursuing the main goal is to love the Lord our God with our whole heart. And that is what the main command is, with all our power and everything. But it's a ongoing, lifelong journey, I think, to get to that space. And so we will continue to change and to want to change for the rest of our lives. And wholeness, I would say, is when there's real coherent work in you. Everything, every part in you, you understand the alignment, you understand the ranking order of your inner human being. Your heart is in the position it has to be, but it's aligned with a choice of choosing God's truth and inviting the Holy Spirit as the main companion and the main source of truth and the counselor to get there. And I think while you are having that desire, primary goal, your biggest why, then the peace and the harmony will be there, and the wholeness flows from that, if that makes sense. So if I want to serve God with a whole heart, I have to be willing to give him my whole heart, even the dark spots and the hidden parts, and he needs to have free entrance into every area in my life. There can't be areas where I feel not now, you know, later. So it's a opening up and saying, Lord, you are so welcome, and I know I am safe in your light.
Wow. Dr. Gary, thank you so much for your time. Thank you for sharing your knowledge. Thank you for your inspiration. And thank you for writing a book on something that I think we all think about at some point in our life, actually continuously, but find it so difficult. And I think the way that you've broken it down in the book, and the things that you've, the amazing knowledge that you've shared in terms of making us understand things more practically, makes it so much more tangible to actually create positive change in our own lives. And I truly believe that within these pages lies the answer for so many people to make the change in their life, to become the people who they want to be, to unlock their full potential, and to become whole and flourish in life. So for that, I truly thank you. And the conversation has been immensely powerful for me at a very personal level. So I do appreciate that. We end off our conversation with quick fire questions, which are a lot easier to answer usually. So I'm going to ask you a few questions, and you just answer with the first thing that pops up in your mind. Which book are you currently reading?
Oh, books.
Books.
I've finished last pages on Bessel van der Kolk's book. He's a psychiatrist. The Body Talks, I think it's the book's name. And then I'm busy with a fiction with Joel Rosenberg, the Libyan something. Yeah, I love his books. He's a expert on Israel and so on. So yeah, very, very good.
Best book, piece of advice you've ever received?
Stop worrying. Yeah.
As simple as that. Name one item on your bucket list.
Oh, Marco, you've got me. My bucket list is to have a place where I can just write.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah.
Your go-to activity to relax or unwind?
Nature. Rocks in front of Kleinmond's house. Mm. Yeah.
What series are you currently watching?
No. Not at the moment.
Good answer. What is your favorite outdoor activity?
Walking.
Cool.
Yeah. With our dog, Nielsi.
That's so cute. Dr. Gaddi, thank you once again. It's been such an honor to have you on the Courage Podcast.
It was a pleasure, privilege and a pleasure. Thank you.
To start unlocking your true potential, grab your copy of Change of Heart today, available online at Kumbooks. Thanks for listening to the Framework to Flourish podcast, hosted by Marco Haasbroek and produced in collaboration with Imagine This. For today's episode, Stefanie de Toey was our coordinator, with Kayla Netling as the assistant. John Rahoog was our technical producer and Karina Kloppers our content producer. Follow us on Facebook, Instagram or LinkedIn at Flourish Workshops to stay up to date with our latest episodes, workshops and retreats. Until next time, keep going and growing.